This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's all wrapped up in that same story of what it means, what that little red barn means, this kind of return to a mythical past. And historically, that's what fascism has always relied on, this mythical return to a past that never existed, in blaming immigrants and journalists and women and minorities as standing in the way of that.
Did you know that this country has a host of so-called ag-gag laws in place that criminalize the work of photographers and journalists who expose abuses on factory farms? This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with investigative journalist Will Potter, whose new book, Little Red Barns, Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable, gives us a dark but thought-provoking view of factory farming. We talk about his research, hear what it reveals about our food system and this country's veering towards fascism, and look at how American agriculture has changed over the past century. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Will Potter. Will is an investigative journalist and author, and his latest book, which comes out June 24th, is entitled Little Red Barns, Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable. Will, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's good to talk to you.
So let's start with the title, Little Red Barns. You use this as a powerful symbol that has been kind of greenwashing the agricultural mystique behind America for many years. Explain why you decided to call this Little Red Barns.
I arrived at that after this was a 10-year investigation of industrial agriculture, and I kept digging and digging and really got to the origin of our ideas of farming, and I think that is the Little Red Barn. I mean, I had the playset when I was a child, my siblings and cousins did. As we grow up, you know, we're taught Old MacDonald, and we have the images in our picture books, and then we see them as adults on product labels and billboards and advertisements. And at its core, it's, I think, one of the first, or if not the first, story that we learn about our relationship with animals and food and the natural world. And it's one that carries with us our whole lives, and I think is a powerful, or has been used as a powerful weapon to keep us in the dark about changes that have actually taken place in the industry.
Yes, when you get a carton of milk or you see eggs or whatever it might be from our food system, you will see things like, it may not be a red barn per se, but it'll be similar bucolic images. I mean, it makes sense from a marketing standpoint. You want to evoke nature and you're eating something from the natural world, but the way that came to you is very different from the way it may have come to your table in 1880.
And what I realized is we as consumers and as individuals have missed that transition. So we're kind of stuck in that era, that very romantic, nostalgic era. And you're right, it's not just the Little Red Barns, it's the happy little farmers and the pasture green fields and the animals dotting the countryside. And what happened over, particularly starting around the 1950s and then accelerating rapidly, was all of that's been not completely erased, but dominated by an industry marked by consolidation, industrialization, mechanization, that's really unrecognizable from that picturesque image that we're raised with.
Why don't I just quote from your introduction in this book where you write, "Writing this book has been a 10-year journey. What began as a study of factory farming led me to an investigation of censorship laws, government repression, political corruption, and the rise of global fascism. All of it joined in a tangled cause and effect loop within an increasingly alarming context of climate change and ecological collapse." So Why don't you expand on the genesis of this and how you reached these conclusions? That is just as much a part of this story as the story itself in some ways.
Absolutely. And that's why the book is really a personal narrative in addition to an investigation, because it was this journey that began after I published my first book, Green is the New Red, which investigated how environmentalists were being labeled as the number one domestic terrorism threat by the FBI. And what I saw happen as I was trying to sound that alarm about this FBI overreach and attack on our civil rights was a radical escalation. And so soon after the book was published, these tactics were spreading to new laws that made it illegal to even take photographs of factory farms, or what are called CAFOs, and classified that act of journalism and whistleblowing and investigation as terrorism. So the project started with really trying to both expose that and understand how this was happening. How did we reach a point where now even purely nonviolent and even First Amendment protected activity was being criminalized as a terrorism threat, while all the abuses that were being exposed by this photography and video were not? And as I dug into that, I was doing things like flying drones over factory farms to try to get around these censorship laws and document environmental pollution. And it just became this kind of absurdist loop that I fell down, or rabbit hole, of seeing how these tactics of censorship and misinformation were so quickly evolving. Like, at first I thought this was really a story about that terrorism rhetoric and laws banning journalism. But over time, I saw those tactics evolve into restrictions on information, removing climate data from government databases, censoring and restricting the language that government reports are using, lobbying, corporate influence, and then ultimately connecting the dots between this authoritarian shift that we're seeing right now in the United States. And that was, I think, the most profound shift for me personally in this journey, was recognizing that that story of the Little Red Barn isn't just the story of farming. It's also the very same story that authoritarians are using when they talk about Make America Great Again and returning to traditional gender roles and this kind of mythological past. A lot of times they invoke the exact same imagery, and even the far right is using rhetoric around diet and consuming meat and raw milk and trad wives and all of these things. It's just this interconnected mess of narrative that are being used to hide both the farms and the shift in agriculture, but also hiding the more dangerous rise of fascism behind it as well.
So you mentioned how these environmental groups and animal rights groups were labeled as just dangerous terrorist threats by the FBI. Is that why I remember seeing some expose on like 60 Minutes or something like 15 years ago about chicken farming, and they had to have all this secret footage? Is that why that was, that they just couldn't just like sign off, hey, we want to come visit the Tyson chicken farm in Nashville, Tennessee? They'd be like, no, you have to sneak in and do something semi-legal to do it.
That's exactly what was happening. And around that time period, too, there was a big shift in activism and in journalism, you know, in the mid-aughts, mid-2000s, where new technology became more and more accessible. We had the rise of social media, YouTube. Activists were able to investigate and collect footage that was of a higher quality and also distribute it without traditional media outlets. And so there's this huge shift in the public discussion, because all of a sudden we're seeing video footage that the industry has been trying to hide. And you had major outlets like 60 Minutes and NBC and CBS and New York Times going with these activists and using this footage. And what happened is the industry completely flipped out. All of a sudden, an industry, the factory farming industry, that had been operating really out of sight and out of mind for nearly all consumers, was in the headlines. It was on TV. It was on social media. These videos were getting millions and millions of views. And the industry responded, rather than trying to address what the activists were exposing, they tried to shut down the investigations. And that's why they started pushing these laws incredibly quickly at the state level. There's also some federal legislation that's dangerous called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act that they passed. But this is really state by state. There were some cases where immediately after an investigation of one of these factory farms took place, you had industry reps sitting down with lawmakers around the kitchen table, drafting the legislation to criminalize that video, and then using their allies in the state houses to push that through and to make it a crime to expose what the industry was doing.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Will Potter. His latest book is Little Red Barns. So, Will, this obfuscation by the factory farming industry, the censorship of photographs and images, it's almost as if they're making it illegal to have ingredients lists on your food. This is our food we're talking about. So it's like, I just want to see where it comes from. That's all. Like, we're not like looking to, you know, I guess they could say like, well, we have secret technology that allows our birds to be, we don't want competitors to see how we do it. But ultimately, the consumer should be able to see where their food comes from. But it's like if it was illegal to put an ingredient list on a ketchup bottle, let's say.
I think it's an important point to remember that what's being exposed at its core are standard industry practices. You know, we're not talking about some proprietary secret method of agriculture that the industry, you know, and they've even tried later on, they use this language of trade secrets and things like that, which is just nonsense. Because what's being exposed are just the day-to-day realities of what our industrialized food system looks like and how it operates. And the reason that's such a threat, though, and I would argue the reason that everyone should be concerned about this, this isn't just an animal issue or an environmental issue. If you eat food, like, this is something that affects you. And the industry, fundamentally, they made repeated statements that they don't think consumers have the right to know where that food comes from, that we don't have the right to see inside of these places. We should be content with showing up at the grocery store, you buy the product, you see the happy little label. And to ask for more than that is when they tried to shut everything down and keep us in the dark.
We've done a lot of pieces on factory farming over the years, but maybe it'd be useful for us to recap here how our agricultural production system has changed over the last 125 years. You quote in the book that in 1900, 41% of the nation's labor force was engaged in agriculture. That's under 2% today. That's basically the advent of machines and efficient ways of producing food. So what is the problem with that? Obviously, we've also had a population explosion since 1900, so we have a lot more mouths to feed.
That's the heart of it, that over this period of time, there are a few major changes in our culture. There was industrialization, there's a change in geography where people are living as we have railroads and the road system become more developed. People are moving to city centers and they're more and more detached from farming. They're fewer families actually working and living on the farms. You know, we have to remember it wasn't very long ago that most Americans were either directly connected to their food, like growing it, raising it in their communities, and also the products that we use. You know, it's been a pretty short timeline that we've shifted to a culture where no matter what you need, you just pop down to the store. Now it's whatever you need, you get online and you can have it within a day, right? And that, I think we take for granted how much of a just a seismic shift that was in a relatively short period of time. And so what happened as we became like geographically isolated from farming and agriculture, it also became mentally removed from us. It became less, less and less part of our daily lives. Some of the research I found on how little most people currently know about our food system was really shocking. We're completely detached from it. And what's happened, and the reason that's a problem, is that in the absence of that, our presence, we've missed the shift in the industry. And it's been a shift in consolidation. So we're seeing an industry dominated by a handful of players. It's not a bunch of small family farms. It's massive corporations that are really putting those farms out of business. And we're also not seeing how the farms have shifted in terms of how they operate and look and function. You know, we think of animals kind of walking free in the pasture. Factory farms are consolidating for efficiency thousands, and in the case of eggs and poultry, it can be hundreds of thousands or even over a million birds on one operation. And what that has meant is the industry has prioritized that efficiency above all else. So animals are removed from their natural instincts and, you know, raising chickens, they're not able to flap their wings. They're not able to roll around in the dust. They're not able, you know, pigs are separated from their piglets at birth. Dairy cows live a lot of their lives on concrete floors. Every aspect of this is so different than what we think of when we think of that little red barn. And this has implications, well, as I talk about in the book, not just for the animals, how the workers are treated, the environmental impact. Because when you think about shifting from those cows walking around in the field, pooping on the grass, you know, nature is kind of an inherently beautiful system where resources are recycled, go into the earth, animals are consuming the grass and wandering around. When you concentrate all of that waste, some of these facilities are producing more waste than entire U.S. cities. And that waste is ending up in the water and the air and completely decimating quality of life and also one of the top contributors to climate change. So I know that's dumping a lot of information, but this shift to factory farming is redefining our relationship with food, and it's also shifting that relationship with the natural world.
So Will, in the book, you write about the intersection of factory farming and fascism. We tend to think of politics and food as two very separate bubbles in the Venn diagram, but there's a lot of overlap. The more obvious connection is the lobbying that these wealthy corporations who are engaged in factory farming do in terms of influencing the political process. But it goes both ways, doesn't it? Why don't you talk about how politics can influence factory farming's explosion and expansion as well?
No, that's a great question. I found this kind of interconnected mess. The way that the FBI has relentlessly focused on these nonviolent activists has become the post 9/11 playbook of restricting speech and information. And so in a lot of ways, some of the restrictions I'm seeing right now as this accelerates in the U.S. are direct mimics of tactics I've seen over the years against these animal activists investigating factory farms. But it goes even deeper than that, because what I found in my research was that the FBI was actually told repeatedly by its own inspector general, by government agencies, that their obsessive focus on protecting agriculture and animal industries was coming at the expense of public safety. And particularly, they were told that by focusing on things like undercover investigations and protesters of factory farms, they're allowing for the rise of violent far-right movements. And of course, that's precisely what we've seen happen. And then I would also add into this mix a little bit messier of a connection of that the ideology behind these systems. I mean, they're really about domination and control, and they're most extreme. And so what we're seeing right now, for instance, white supremacists have held rallies where they're doing things like chugging raw milk because they see it as a sign of racial superiority, because black and brown folks, and particularly Asian communities, are often have higher rates of lactose intolerance.
You couldn't make that up.
You can't make it up. And it sounds nutty and it sounds silly, but this is really baked into their talking points. The same thing with this, the raw eggs, raw milk, the carnivore diet. You know, Tucker Carlson has had all these episodes about, you know, the raw eggs and raw milk and all this stuff.
Makes you a manly man.
Makes you a manly man. You know, this is how we own the libs. You know, they call, you know, if you're woke, they call you a soy boy, right? That's an insult because you're not a manly meat eater. But it's also more nefarious than that, because it's really wrapped up in this deeper ideology about power and violence and control. And so that's why you see, like, some of the publishers of these texts that were on the Tucker Carlson show and others are literally publishing Nazi propaganda. Like, this is what they do. One of them was called Antelope Press, and they put out all this, you know, raw milk, raw egg, masculine meat-eating stuff. And they're also putting out books praising the Third Reich, praising fascists, talking about white supremacy. So as kind of bizarre as some of this sounds to, I would imagine, most of your listeners, they're seeing these things as directly connected. And like I said, it's all wrapped up in that same story of what it means, what that little red barn means, this kind of return to a mythical past. And historically, that's what fascism has always relied on, this mythical return to a past that never existed, in blaming immigrants and journalists and women and minorities as standing in the way of that.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Will Potter. He's an investigative journalist and an author. His latest book is entitled Little Red Barns, Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable. I didn't quite understand the connection you were making in the book when you were talking about the Earl Butz misquote. Earl Butz, is, for our listeners, was a former Secretary of Agriculture under Ford and Nixon, and he's often quoted as saying, get big or get out, which kind of meant economies of scale are coming. Why don't you explain the connection there on why Butz's supposed quote is important and how it's being used, even if it were never said?
It's interesting because it's treated as true because that's what happened. I mean, there was such a shift in consolidation. Small farming was decimated. The family farm was decimated. What I found in my research, though, is it's a lot more complex than that, that this wasn't just the government saying, okay, these economies of scale are coming, you better get with the program or you're not going to make it. It was much more methodical than that. What I found, and I think one of a better explanation of how this factory farming shift happened, was the government was pumping money into land-grant colleges in these research centers that were intended as a bridge to really help the farming community, to help rural America. And it became co-opted by industry. And these colleges became dominated by corporate interests, you know, coming up with new pesticides and growth hormones, new machinery, vertical integration schemes, consolidation schemes, all of these things that I found in congressional hearings, people were opposing because they didn't benefit the small farmers. And what I really struggled with this whole investigation was, as a journalist, we call it bearing witness. Like, how are we exposing the industry like never before? There's more information than we've ever had access to as human beings and consumers. It's all on tape. It's all on our phone. It's all on YouTube and the nightly news. And yet, a lot of this stuff just isn't changing. And the industry is just dominating the narrative. Unless we can see past the narrative that's being presented, we're not going to be able to just use facts alone. I think we have to get to the core of this, which is we've been sold a false bill of goods our entire lives. We've been cultured to believe this false narrative since we were children. Since before we could speak, we're learning Old MacDonald, we're pointing to the Little Red Barn and picture books. And I think we have to go that deep. And I know that's overwhelming. And as a journalist, it's kind of disempowering because I want to think that, well, if I can just go out there and document the climate change impact or show what's happening to the small farmer, that should be enough to make a change. But I think we have to unpack these layers of lies that we've been sold our entire lives. And I think that's my grounds for hope, that once we can get a true handle on this story and break through that mythology, all of a sudden we can start seeing alternatives. We can start seeing new ways of rewriting that story in a sustainable way.
And if you think about how food messaging has changed, we don't want to change our habits because food is delicious and we want to consider it delicious. We don't want to feel guilty about eating what is healthy food generally. And so there needs to be this common ground where we can be informed and want something better while still being able to eat without guilt.
I think that's a key point here. And also, these are conversations and information that we want to know, but at the same time, like, we can't go to these farms ourselves. We have to trust that the inspectors and others are making sure that when we see these labels about humane and, you know, environmentally friendly and pasture raised and all these different terms, that they actually mean something. Like, because I think you're right that we want to do the right thing. And I think that's why these industry attempts are so dangerous, because they're removing that oversight. They're removing that accountability. They're making sure even third parties like journalists and investigators can't expose the truth. And in the absence of that, I think it leaves consumers really susceptible to the marketing gimmicks, because we want to buy the healthy, the sustainable thing. And unless we have real information, real checks and balances, we're not able to do that.
Will Potter is an author and investigative journalist. His latest book is Little Red Barns, Hiding the Truth from Farm to Fable. Will, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's great talking to you, Alex. I appreciate it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Polyrhythmics, The Clash, and The Radiators. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.